Hello there, and welcome to In Your Own Kin. I'm your host, Charlotte. I'm a lover of great food, sometimes artist, sleep-in advocate, storyteller, mama, and postpartum professional in Naarm, Melbourne. Each week, I'll be chatting to families about their journey into parenthood, the grandest of adventures. Parenting is beautiful, messy, sparkly, hard work. You were never meant to do this alone. It's time to get comfy in your own kin. In Your Own Kin acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land where you are listening to today's episode. I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize that the telling of stories has happened here since time immemorial. In Your Own Kin is recorded by the Birrarung on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty of these lands has not and is not ceded, and it remains stolen. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. In this week's episode, Beth shares her parenthood journey and life with her husband Rob and their daughter Emily. In so many ways, this episode feels like the love letter that all of us need to receive in those hazy first few weeks and months. Beth speaks openly and honestly about feeling inundated with advice and information, the shift that came with tuning out from the noise, the importance of finding what worked for her and her baby, and just how important a kinship network is. We talk about breastfeeding challenges and wins, biologically normal infant sleep, and finally realizing that no one will ever know your babe as well as you do. Oof. You're going to love this one. Here's Beth. Beth, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It's such a joy to be hearing your story.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here because I've listened to the podcast myself and it's a great podcast, so I'm excited to be on it.
I always get very excited when I get a story submission come through the website. So when yours popped up, I was like, yay.
Oh, I think I was just searching on your, or something came up on your Instagram page and I saw that link there and I was like, oh, I'm going to put a submission in because, yeah, there's definitely parts of my story that I would love to tell. So yeah, very excited to be here.
Oh, thank you for joining us. Would you like to begin by letting the listeners know a little bit about yourself, who's in your family and where you're living at the moment, Beth?
Yeah, no worries. So I'm from a suburb in southeast Melbourne called Officer. I live with my husband, my daughter, who's almost one. She's one on Saturday and I can't believe she's already one. It's gone so quick. And we have two little, very energetic dogs as well. So yeah, they're a joy that's added to the family. Can be very naughty as well, but lots of fun.
We constantly talk about the need to have a dog in our house to help with the food cleanup. Talk to me about food cleanup, Beth.
Oh, yes. Oh my gosh. They are the best. You do not need a vacuum when you have a dog, and especially with a baby. The dogs go technically outside when my daughter Emily is eating because they like to try and get the food off the high chair. But then the moment she finishes eating, it's just, all right, let them back in. And they do all the cleanup for us. It's great.
This is what I need in my life. Honestly, the like 5+ times a day cleanup off the floor is, oh my goodness.
They're very well-fed dogs though. We do have to watch anything else that we feed them. They get fed multiple times a day now.
Beth, would you like to tell me a little bit about what makes your heart sing? Tell us a bit more about you.
Well, I am a teacher, so very passionate about working with young people. Yeah, there's probably sides to teaching, especially these days, that are great and sides that I find really difficult now. And I think because working in the education system these days, you have to work towards assessments and all that kind of stuff. The side of working with young children that I like is very much that inspiring and, you know, being a bit more flexible. So I've kind of started to make a bit of a shift in where I want to go. And my postpartum journey has actually really influenced that. And I'm starting to kind of work towards, like yourself, being a postpartum doula. So So I'm also very passionate about yoga. So that's something I really want to bring into it as well. I've always wanted to do my yoga teacher training, and something I did all the time before becoming a parent, obviously now being very time constrained. Yeah. Don't do it at practice as much as I'd like to, but as Emily gets older, I'm practicing more and more. So yeah, I guess that's a bit about me, my passions, and where I'm heading towards at the moment.
So exciting. I think it's so fascinating how postpartum can shape and shift your identity. My gosh.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. I think you get a more sense of what's important to you.
Yes.
Because obviously what's most important to you is this new baby and spending time with them. And any time you spend outside of spending time with them, you want it to be really important. So yeah, it's definitely shifted my perception of where I'm kind of heading towards in the future and what I want to do with my time.
Yeah. Oh, that's so exciting. Yeah. Talk to me about life when it was you and Robert.
Oh, it was pretty good. We were, you know, young. We got married at the age of 25, I think we were. We'd built a house. You know, I'd just started teaching. Rob was getting promotions in his area of work. We loved going out for dinner. We loved sitting at home drinking wine. We went to the gym. We did a lot of yoga. So we're probably very carefree and very lucky people, I guess. We had a pretty awesome life. And yeah, we always wanted kids. And that was something that was always in our mindsets and where we wanted to go. Rob, my husband, is very, very family orientated, and I know he always wanted to be a dad, and that was something that I'd always imagined as well. Like, even before having a partner, if you had said to me, when you're older, you're on your deathbed, what's one thing you want to have achieved in life? It would definitely have been family. So we'd always spoken about it, I guess. And I think we always knew maybe within a couple of years after getting married that would probably start that process. But I remember when we actually started talking, okay, when are we going to do this? It was the beginning of 2019. And I remember sitting at dinner, actually at the winery that we got married at, and we're having dinner there, just having a glass of wine. And Rob turned to me and said, okay, I'm ready. And I was really glad he said that. I guess we're kind of on the same wavelength, because I'd already been thinking, oh, you know, like, be nice to maybe start trying by the end of this year. So when he turned to me and said that, I was like, okay, perfect, I am too. And we put a time frame on it. I think I was in my second year of teaching by then. So I really wanted to see out the year of teaching. So I think we thought, let's start trying maybe mid-year that year. But then we decided to do a bit of traveling. I said, let's go to India and Nepal.
Magic.
Oh, it was so amazing. And something I'm so glad we did. So then that was kind of like our time frame then. We said, okay, we'll do India and Nepal and then we'll start trying to conceive.
And talk to me about finding out you were pregnant.
I guess I was very lucky. I always thought for some reason that it would be a long process. I have a lot of friends and family who had a really long journey trying to conceive. So that was always, I guess, almost a fear of mine that it would take a while. But it was only, I think, 2 months. I can't imagine it taking so long, because even 2 months, when you're trying and you really want it to happen, it feels like forever.
It's all consuming.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, we weren't in a rush or anything either, but once you've made that decision and you want it so badly, I remember that first month when it didn't happen, it was really devastating. So yeah, we were lucky in that regard.
And talk to me about finding out. Talk to me about that moment.
It was a funny day, actually. Spent the day doing up our backyard, and I remember I thought that I wasn't pregnant because I thought I'd got my period. So I was really devastated. Again, I was like, oh, okay, another month of trying. And I actually went over, my dad and my brother were helping us, and I went over to my parents' house in the morning because we were going to go to a market to get some plants. And when I was there, my mum said to me, oh, guess what? Your cousin's having a baby. And I was like, oh, really? I already had my sister-in-law and my brother were expecting a baby. I had another cousin expecting a baby, and now there was a second cousin expecting a baby. So to hear that on a day where I thought that I wasn't there yet, it was actually, as excited I was for them, it was really hard. So I remember, because I hadn't told Mum that we were trying or anything, so I remember holding back tears when she told me. It's funny thinking about it now, because later that night I was lying in bed and I just could not fall asleep. And I remember thinking that my period was really light, which was really unusual. Like, it usually gets really heavy on the first day. And then I think it was like around midnight, and I was thinking maybe it was just, what's it called, the egg attaching when the bleeding that happens then.
Yeah.
So I was like, ooh. And so that popped into my mind, and I was like, well, I can't get this out of my head now. I have to get up and do a pregnancy test. And luckily I had one in the cupboard, and I did it, and a little faint line came up. Oh, so I was actually pregnant the whole time. And then I had to wake up my husband and tell him, and then he was half asleep. He had an excited reaction, but he was half asleep. And I remember him waking up the next morning and just being like, was that a dream, or did he actually tell me? That. But yeah, looking back on it now, it's quite a funny day, but at the time it wasn't so funny.
It's so hard, isn't it? I think we need to have that conversation more openly, because it's such an all-consuming thing at that point. That
it is.
Yeah. And you're so up in your head. I think regardless of how long it can take, it just feels like a lifetime.
Yeah. And it's funny, I didn't expect to be like that at all. Yeah, it's funny, once you're in that moment and you have that mindset of, okay, we're ready, how badly you want it. Yeah, it is. It's all consuming.
And how are you feeling in the pregnancy? How are you feeling physically?
I was really lucky. I think the worst I had was in the first trimester. And being a teacher, I was really lucky as well. Pretty much my entire first trimester was over the summer school holidays. So I think I spent the entire holidays just lying on the couch and eating hot chips, salty hot chips. But yeah, I wasn't really sick or anything. I just was very lethargic, very tired, a few food aversions and things like that. But otherwise, by the time the second trimester came around, I was really good, and I was, you know, going back into the gym and, yeah, exercising and eating better again, and felt really good. I was pretty lucky. I had a pretty easy pregnancy.
Oh, amazing. And how are you traveling emotionally?
Yeah, excited, I think. Everyone kept asking me, you know, how I felt about it. And at the time, I think I spent a lot more of my mental energy concerned about the birth and researching the birth and getting ready for the birth, and probably not enough for the postpartum period.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm seriously nodding.
Yeah. And I think it's a story I hear a lot now, you know, networking with other mums and things like that, is that I think because it is such a big thing that you have to prepare for and that you have to go through giving birth, your mind goes to that and preparing for that. But that's one day. It's one day of your life, and the baby is forever. So
yeah. And you're so right. Like, it's not about taking away from preparing for birth, because I think that also plays significantly into your postpartum experience, but to focus on that moment can really set you up for a little bit of a wobbly start.
Yeah, definitely. More so around your expectations, I think.
Yes.
Because, you know, you can't research your postpartum period. You don't know who your baby's going to be and what your baby's going to need, and every baby's different. So it's not something you can research to prepare for, but I think, yeah, your expectations need to be a bit more open, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, I often talk about postpartum planning as like the best laid plan is the plan that grows with your family, because my gosh, you're so right. You don't know what your baby's going to be like. But just that setting up of the kinship support network is so important, right?
Yeah. That's the best way to prepare, I think, is knowing where to go for support for different things, and, yeah, having those people around you and even things like setting up a meal roster with people or getting to know, you know, the support systems in your local area. And that's the best way to prepare. When I say I didn't prepare for the postpartum period, I did do a little bit of, you know, listening to podcasts with sleep consultants and all that kind of stuff, because I thought that was the best way to prepare at the time. Also buying things, you know, you buy things and think, oh, I'm prepared because I have a cot and I have, you know, a baby swing, but my baby hated the baby swing, so that wasn't good preparation. Really, the best way to prepare is to know that you have the support and to build those kinship networks.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Just think it's such a game changer, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Talk to me about the birthday. Talk to me about meeting Emily.
My waters broke quite early. So I think it was the Wednesday night, and that was kind of the first sign of labor. And then those early stages of labor went for quite a long time. So I kept going into the hospital. They kept sending me home. I went back in again. They sent me home again. But then it ended up being over 24 hours that my waters had broken. So I ended up having to be in hospital, hooked up to the CTG. I needed antibiotics, which I really wanted to avoid because I guess the potential effects it can have on gut health and things like that. And, you know, I wasn't GBS positive or anything, so there was no other reason to need it. So I was disappointed with having to, yeah, have antibiotics and also being hooked up to the CTG, because I imagined laboring being a bit more free and, you know, being able to move around a bit more freely. But because I did have the CTG hooked up, I felt very constricted in my movement and I had to kind of just lay on the bed. So that was really frustrating. All in all, it was a really good birth. And that was where I had done a lot of preparation mentally for going through birth. So I was really proud that, you know, I got through it the way I wanted to in terms of with as little medical intervention as possible. So I got through it just through breathing and, you know, using my husband for support. I was quite proud of my birth in the end.
All of that birth prep really giving you that emotional strength to get through, because it's a big emotional game, right? It's a mind game.
Yeah.
Birth.
Oh, it definitely is. Yeah, it's definitely a mindset. Yeah, if you want to prepare for birth, you can go to a place in your mind and just breathe through it. That was the best way for me.
And talk to me about those first few moments with Emily.
I remember when the midwives were telling me, like, she's almost here, you're almost ready. And I remember just having this feeling of elation. And I remember turning to Rob and being like, oh my God, we're about to meet our baby. So I remember in the midst of labor having that excitement. And yeah, after she was born, they put her straight onto my chest. And I didn't know if she was a boy or a girl. So the midwife said, have a look. After they put her on my chest, I lifted her up to have a look. And I remember people warning me about this, that down there is very swollen. So when I had a look, I thought she was a boy. So I went, oh, it's a boy. And then the midwife said, no, look again. I went, oh, it's a girl. And then we'd already had our names picked out. So I turned to Rob and said, oh, it's Emily. And she came out eyes wide open and she was just laying on my chest, looking towards Rob and staring at Rob in the eyes. So that's my first memory of her. And she's still has big eyes. It's a good first memory to have.
Oh, how magic.
Yeah, it was very magical. I think she was on me for a good hour or two and, you know, had our first feed and everything. And then it was after that when I got up and had a shower and Rob got to do skin to skin with her and hold her. And they're some of my favorite photos too. I have some photos of her just lying on Rob. And yeah, just the look on his face. It was, yeah, really magical. And then he got to FaceTime. Obviously, being in the middle of COVID as well, we didn't get to have family come and see her straight away. So we used that time still in the birth suite to FaceTime our families, our parents. And yeah, it was a really magical little time.
So special. And talk to me about those first few days together. How were you feeling at that point?
To begin with, quite overwhelmed. I remember we spent, I think, 3 days in the hospital. Emily passed the meconium while she was still in the sac. So she had to be monitored, I think it was every 4 hours for the first couple of days after birth. So it's felt very interrupted. Every 4 hours, we had someone come in and check her temperature and just check that, you know, her breathing and everything. And I remember thinking, I just can't wait to be home and just be just our little family on our own. While it was great being in hospital, and I remember, yeah, just feeling just constantly interrupted. There was people coming in all the time to check on her. And then when there wasn't people coming to check on her, that's when, you know, the meals would come around and someone would knock on the door and be like, here's your meal. And I felt like I had to wake her up all the time too. And I remember thinking, I just want to go with the flow and just be at home and let her sleep when she wants to sleep and feed when she wants to feed. And I remember being overwhelmed by that at the beginning. Yeah, that's when I think issues started to arise as well, because I think it was day 2 or 3 or whenever it is when they weigh her, is when we realized that she'd almost lost more than 10% of her body weight. That's when more stresses were added in. And I just remember the first few weeks and days being so stressful because of problems with her weight and feeding. And it started to snowball a bit from there after that. It wasn't a fun time postpartum.
Oh, Beth.
Something I had also done a lot of research on and prep for was breastfeeding, because that was something that was really important to me and something that I wanted to be able to do is exclusively breastfeed. So when she wasn't putting on weight, we had a lactation consultant in the hospital, and they suggested to pump after every feed to build up my supply. And I think it was one of the maternal health nurses who visited afterwards told me to start taking domperidone, which is one of those medical galactagogues to try and build up your supply. So I started on that. And the whole process of that was so stressful. Mm-hmm. And Emily just wanted to feed constantly. So I was like, how am I meant to pump when she just wants to feed the entire time? Like, how am I meant to fit this in? I don't understand. And it was just all so confusing. And when you're in that kind of period of your life for the first time ever, and and you're so sleep deprived, it's really hard to kind of navigate what it is you're meant to be doing and how you're meant to make it all work. And you listen to the health professionals giving you this advice, and you just go, okay, this is what I'm meant to do, but why is it so hard and why isn't it working? And we went back into the hospital every few days to keep getting her weighed. I think she started to plateau her weight, so she wasn't losing anymore, but she wasn't really putting any back on, or if she was, it was very, very slow. So I remember, I think it was within her second week of life, and she was also like, she was so unsettled. Like every time I stopped feeding her, she just wasn't content. And my mum was there, and she saw how much this was affecting me. And she said, just give her a bottle. I think you just need to give her a bottle of formula, because you can't continue like this. And I remember just bursting into tears and just being like, but why? Like, I shouldn't have to, and this isn't what I want to do. But I gave in and I did it, and I gave her a bottle of formula, and I felt like, because I felt like I was starving her. It was really hard, you know, to be able to trust my body and just trust that it was enough. So I ended up giving her a bottle of formula, and we continued that for a while. Even after getting support as well, I ended up seeing a IBCLC, and yeah, the advice was always the same, to express and to build up my supply, but I just felt like it wasn't working. But yeah, looking back on it now, it's funny, you doubt yourself and you wonder.
Absolutely.
You wonder whether, like, was it just that I wasn't feeding her enough and wasn't building up my supply? Or, yeah, it's funny to look back on now, and you look back on it and you think, was it me? Or you always doubt yourself, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like you said, it's the first time you've ever done this.
Yeah.
And even if it's your second or third or fourth or fifth or sixth baby, no matter how many children you have, it's the first time you're breastfeeding or chest feeding that baby, and they're learning as well. And it's just such a steep learning curve.
Yeah, it really is. I think you can do all the research on it as well, but until you experience it, you need to go through the, you know, the ups and downs of it to figure out how it works for you and for your baby. Yeah, it was a tough journey at the beginning.
There's no way for me to perfectly frame this question, so apologies if this feels clunky.
That's right.
But we were talking beforehand as well, and you've kind of reflected on being inundated with advice and listening to you speak just now, I feel like there are inklings of, like, in hindsight, something. What was your gut telling you at that point? What felt right in you at that point, Beth?
I remember thinking there has to be something, a reason why this isn't working. You know, I just thought that, you know, there has to be something there. So I remember, I think it was, she was around 5 weeks old when I started looking at things like tongue ties. And I thought, you know what? And I looked at the symptoms of it and I thought, you know what, this could be it, because she was also, I guess, what they call colicky. So I went, it was like a lactation consultant who's also a GP who looks at things like oral ties. And at the time she told me that she was fine, that she said she had a slight lip tie, but it was nothing that needed to be, you know, revised or anything. So I trusted that advice, but I still felt like there had to be something. She had a lot of reflux symptoms as well, and she was just never settled. And yeah, there's all this advice, and something that's, it does have its benefits, but something that is a big trap you can fall into is social media and joining groups with other mothers who have been through similar things. Because I remember all of these things coming up. I would post in a group and be like, this is my baby's symptoms. This is what's happening. This is what's happening with feeding. Mm. And you would get hundreds of comments being like, oh, it sounds like this. It could be this. Mm-hmm. It could be this. And you just start going, oh my gosh, what is wrong with my baby? There's something wrong. Like, Googling as well is another trap you fall into.
You're never going to put your symptoms in and get like, you know what, I think everything's fine on Google.
Yeah, exactly. And also when you're a mother and your baby is going through things like this, all you want to do is find out what it is and fix it. And
when
you're not getting answers from anyone else, you turn to Google and try and diagnose it yourself, because you're just like, I need to get to the bottom of this and I need to make it better. It was a whirlwind just trying to figure out what was causing the issue. Yeah, a lot of the early postpartum period was super stressful. Sleep was a big issue too. You know, when isn't it an issue, sleep with a baby? But I remember also being made to feel like that there was something wrong with her sleep, because she was and still is a contact napper. She would not sleep without me. And, you know, some people do have babies that, you know, you can pop them down in a cot and off they go to sleep, and they'll sleep for 2 hours and be happy. So when you speak to other parents of babies like that and you tell them, my baby won't sleep, I can't put her down and she won't sleep on her own, they go, oh, what's wrong? And it makes you feel like there is something wrong. I remember at 3 months, I went to a day-stay sleep school, because I thought, you always think there's going to be some magical answer. So I thought, I'll go to this sleep school and, you know, that might fix her sleep problems. And while it didn't fix her sleep problems and it wasn't what she needed, I'm so glad I did it, because one of the nurses there said to me, I feel like she has a tongue tie. And I said, no, I've had it assessed. I've been down that road and, you know, everyone's telling me she doesn't. And they said, oh, we did this training with a dentist, and he's quite a reputable dentist. So they suggested to me going to this dentist. I remember almost, you know, bursting into tears, thinking, oh gosh, if this is it, when I tried weeks earlier to figure this out. But yeah, we booked in with this dentist and he looked in her mouth for all of 3 seconds and went, yeah, she's definitely got a tongue tie and she's got a lip tie, and this is what could be affecting your feeding. I was like, oh my gosh, you've got to be kidding. We made the decision to get that revised then and there. And then it took a while, but slowly and slowly from there, because we had been pretty much every feed by then, I was topping her up with a bottle. So I would breastfeed, because I just wanted to hold on to breastfeeding for as long as I possibly could. So every feed I was breastfeeding both sides, and then I would top her up with a bottle after that. But yeah, once we had the tongue and lip tie revised, it was a period of quite a few months. She was slowly started drinking less and less of that top-up bottle until we got to a point where she didn't need it at all. I was like, oh, so that must have been it. It must have been the tongue tie. But then I also look at that period of time, and it was around that 4 or 5 month period after having been to the sleep school that I just went, screw it, I'm not listening to what anyone else says about how she's meant to sleep, how she's meant to feed. Yeah. I'm just going to contact nap with her, you know, because that's what she needs. That's how she gets the most sleep. That's, you know, the less stressful option.
Yeah.
I also wonder now as well, because I started just feeding her to sleep and letting her sleep on the breast, whether that was also helping, you know, my supply. And I have a feeling now, looking back on it, that it was a bit of both. You know, she obviously needed to contact nap and breast sleep, as they call it. And yeah, whether the tongue tie was affecting it as well. Hindsight is everything, I guess. I really wish I could go back to that early days and just say, don't listen to anyone else. You know what your baby needs. Your baby obviously just needs to be feeding, to be sleeping with you. And as stressful as it was, and it is a big adjustment, but her contact naps now are my favorite part of the day.
Yes.
And yeah, especially it's definitely hard when they're younger, when they're sleeping a lot. But as they get older, it's now a time for me to just sit down and hold her and relax. And it's almost meditative to me now to be able to contact sleep with her. Yeah, it's the part of the day I look forward to. So I really wish I could just go back in time and say, just enjoy it. Binge watch something on Netflix and just sit and hold her and don't worry about trying to put her down in a cot or, you know, whatever people say you should try and do, just hold her.
Oh, it's so darn hard though, isn't it, Beth? Because you're so right that you're getting inundated with information and advice from every direction. That it's so easy to become overwhelmed. You're going through such a big transition just in yourself that it's really hard to just actually sit and tune in with yourself and think, like, actually, what is my gut telling me right now? What do I need and what does my baby need? Because we so often forget how intrinsically linked our two nervous systems are, right? Like when we're heightened, our little loves are heightened as well.
Yeah, exactly. All you want is what's best for that baby. So when someone like a medical professional or even someone who has simply been a parent before who you think, oh, they must know more than me because they've done it before.
Yeah.
When they tell you, you know, this is how I did it and this is what worked for my baby, you think that that's the right thing to do because
absolutely
you just want to, you want to do what's right for them, but you know what's best for your baby more than anyone else. It's hard, especially going through it the first time, because it's hard to trust yourself. I've already said the second time around, I'm not going to buy all the expensive baby swings and all of that kind of stuff. I want a doula or someone there to support me and, you know, give me that encouragement and tell me that you know what you're doing, just follow your gut, because that's what every mother needs, I think.
Absolutely. It's hard. It's hard to cut through the noise in that haze. You just need, someone that's like, what do you think? What feels right? Let's give it a go. Yep. Did it work? All right. Let's try something else.
Yeah. And does it feel right to you as
well?
Does
it feel right?
Yeah. I remember getting advice about feeding and it was about stretching out feeds. And I remember at the time thinking, she wants to feed more than this. I shouldn't be stretching it out. But because someone told me to do it, I gave it a go. And my gut told me exactly what I needed to hear. It was, you know, it didn't feel right. I shouldn't be doing it. But yeah, it's so hard when you've got so many people telling you so many different things and you just want to do what's best for your baby. It's so hard to drown out that noise.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Talk to me about how you felt that shift in you when you started to tune out from the noise?
Oh, it was a massive difference. I remember just finally feeling like how I imagined my postpartum period would be. I felt like because of the stress of everything that was going on, I just didn't have that moment to enjoy my baby and go, oh my gosh, I have a daughter, I'm a mother, like, isn't this amazing? I completely missed that because I was so stressed out and, you know, there was so much going on. And I don't think it was until she was about 8 months old that I finally had that moment. And I remember one day just looking at her and I started crying, but it was happy tears. And I was like, oh my gosh, look, I have this little daughter. Yeah, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, it's taking me 8 months to get to this stage. I finally started feeling like I'm the mother I'm proud to be, because I just felt like I was failing her, like, you know, it wasn't coming naturally to me. And I'd always thought, because I wanted kids so badly, that mothering would just come naturally to me and it would be, you know, the postpartum period would be easy because I would instinctively know what to do. But it obviously isn't. You go through a big learning journey and it's not as easy as all that. Once I finally just let go and drowned out the noise and just did what felt right, and I started contact napping, we started bed sharing. We didn't try to put her in a cot because we just knew it wasn't working, and feeding her when she wanted to feed. I just started to love being a mother because, yeah, I wasn't loving it to begin with. It was just way too stressful. The difference once I just let go in how I felt about being a mother was a huge, huge difference.
Oh, Beth. I feel like if we really focused on postpartum as a rite of passage and something to celebrate, we could kind of give birthing people the space to have that moment a little earlier on, right? Like if we actually honored this huge transition in a meaningful way, I think we could really shift the landscape of what communities look like at the moment.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It has to be a huge societal shift. Being a mother is kind of taken for granted now, I guess, and it's just something that, you know, oh, so many women and parents do it now. It's easy. It's definitely taken for granted how much support that a new parent needs and how much space we need to give them to learn and to be with the baby and grow alongside them.
Yes. Talk to me about support. Talk to me about what your kinship support networks look like.
I was very lucky in that I had a lot of support, and this is the thing that gets me. Like, I had a lot of support and I struggled. So I can't imagine someone who doesn't have the support that I had, how they would be coping. I had, my husband was amazing and he did everything to look after me so that I could be there to learn how to feed and just to be with Emily's. And he still does it a year on. He still does everything for me. So, yeah, I'm very lucky in that regard. I had my mum, I think for at least the first 4 or 5 months, would just come and grab all of our laundry hampers and clothes and just wash it all for us and bring it back and also bring us food. My mother-in-law brought us food every week and my nana brought us food. Yeah, I did have a great kinship support around me.
It really does take a village to hold a family, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Before we started recording, you said that Emily was what they called a high needs baby.
Yeah.
How were you traveling emotionally? Because it's really tricky when you've got medical professionals kind of labeling your baby in that way. How were you traveling emotionally?
Yeah, it's so hard. I remember we saw a pediatrician when she was around 8 weeks and we were talking about, you know, the troubles that we were having, and they just said, oh, you know, some babies are just like this. They're high needs, you know, they're going to fuss, they're going to cry, and, you know, it's just time. You just need to give them time. The emotion that comes with that of my baby's not happy and there's nothing I can do about it, it's so draining. And the hardest part is you lose what you imagined. You lose that happy postpartum period, you know, the being elated with having a baby, and on top of that, having a baby in the middle of COVID as well, where, you know, you can't do all the things that you wanted to do and can't see or have all the people come around and celebrate with you and support you as well. It was really hard.
Has that changed?
Yeah, definitely. And again, I think it came with changing our mindset more than anything and letting go of expectation and just going with the flow of what Emily needed rather than what society tells you a baby needs. It's funny now, like people say to me, oh, how do you cope? And I don't feel like I'm just coping now. I feel like it's second nature. It's easy. It's what I'm meant to be doing. This is just the way Emily needs to be parented and the way she needs to be. And I can't imagine it any other way now. I can't imagine not having her in our bed every night or ever being away from her for that amount of time even. It's not something I see as a burden. You make it work, but also you don't just make it work. You learn to enjoy it and you know it's not going to last forever. Her nap times when she contact naps with me are my favorite times of the day.
Yeah. Oh, it's so magic. I think that conversation around biologically normal infant sleep is important.
Yes. And once I started to learn about that as well, it was a really, really big moment and what really changed my mindset as well, because there is a lot of expectation around baby sleep. As I said, my idea of preparation for the postpartum period was listening to podcasts about baby sleep, and it just gave a really unrealistic expectation that babies, you know, you put them down in their cot and you need to teach them to self-settle and they'll sleep for an hour or two, and then, you know, the whole feed, play, sleep cycle that everyone's supposedly meant to follow. That completely works for some people, and for some babies, they thrive on that. But the reality is that there are a lot of babies that don't. Learning about biologically normal infant sleep, I think, is probably, if you are going to do any research, that's probably the best one to do, yeah, during pregnancy.
Yeah, I just think it's so interesting, right? We kind of expect babies to be robots and not actually humans. Like, we understand as an adult, like, we're all very different and we have different needs, and some days I'm going to be more hungry than other days. And actually, like today, I can't sleep very well and I'm having a little bit of a wobbly day and I might need a little bit more space holding today. But then we don't necessarily always give that same leeway, and that's not even the right word, to our babies and children.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember seeing something and it said, you know, imagine if you were expected to sleep without your favorite pillow, without, you know, your doona, without your partner, with the light on. And yet we expect, if babies have the exact same environments and everything around them, that they will all sleep the same way. When Emily didn't sleep like that, and when none of that worked, the first thing I thought was that something's wrong. Why isn't she sleeping like that, when it's not the case at all? She's actually quite a normal baby, and most babies need contact to sleep. And, you know, we're considered carry mammals. You know, we're meant to be carrying our babies all the time. They don't know any better. They don't know that you want them to sleep in a cot. That's what they want. I think the society and mainstream advice around sleep really needs to shift a little bit more around just the expectation of what sleep could be like for your baby, and that it's not going to be the same for every single one of them.
Oh, absolutely. Talk to me about returning to work.
Yeah, it was hard returning to work, but I am glad I did it. It's good to be doing something again that, you know, I did before becoming a mother, and kind of being in touch with my old self a little bit. But at the same time, it's amazing how difference I feel in the job now and how my values probably haven't changed, but I'm more in tune with what they are, I think. Because as I said, you just, once you become a mother, you really know what's important to you, and you really just, you only want to do what you really, really value. If you're going to spend time away from your baby, you want it to be important. So it's been an interesting journey returning back to work, but it's something I am glad that I've done.
I think that's so interesting. I feel very similarly, Beth, that being more in tune with myself than ever. And in many ways, I just feel like my ability to like bullshit is really low. I don't know if you've
been saying. Yeah.
I just am kind of like,
that's a good way to describe it.
Not at all PC. But like, you just are like,
Yeah, exactly. Like, nah, things that you maybe would have tolerated before, you're kind of just like, nah, that's, I don't want to do that now. Like, that's not important to me. And anything in your life, I think you kind of know what to filter out now more than ever. Like, you just don't have that tolerance for anything other than what you really want to do and what's really important to you.
Oh, absolutely. Emily is nearly one. Talk to me about how you're feeling about that milestone, your first year as a newborn mama.
I used to hate the saying that the first year is the hardest, because I just feel like, you know, that's just something that everyone says. And I am kind of feeling like it is a new chapter now. Like, the more she grows, and it's scary how quickly she's growing, but I'm loving it more and more. And it's funny looking back at the last year now and how much she's made me a different person. And it's crazy. There's no words to describe it. It's just as scary as it is, and as, you know, as much as you want to say, oh, can you stop growing now? Stay little forever. I'm the opposite. I kind of love watching her grow and watching her learn and growing along with her. And I think about the future now, and it's so exciting. Like, think of all the milestones we have ahead of us, and you know, she's almost walking, and before I know it, she'll be telling me exactly what she wants and talking back at me. And it's so exciting now. Like, all the early stuff is behind us.
If you could go back and tell yourself anything, what would you tell yourself, Beth?
Definitely just to trust myself. And you know, when you hear something and you try it and it doesn't feel right, then you know it's not right. That's the biggest thing. And I think the thing that all mothers need to hear is to trust yourself and listen to what your intuition is telling you.
Oh, Beth, it's been such a joy to listen to your story. And I think there are so many of us that will see ourselves in your experience and feel really reassured.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I hope so. I think that's why I wanted to share it as well, because, we often hear the happy stories of the early days and the newborn bubble and you know, how it's often a really special time. But I look back on that newborn bubble and I don't think of it as a special time, and it's sad that I guess I lost that experience in a way, but it's definitely shaped the mother I've become. My story was definitely something I wanted to tell. So thanks for having me on.
It is such a joy to share these stories with you each week. If you're enjoying the show, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, or share it with someone in your very own kin. You can see all of the gorgeous images of the families that join me each week and get the latest news from Kin on Instagram @KinByCharlotte. I can't wait to chat with you next week.